Broadcasting from a kayak in the middle of a pool, it's the Funk Zone Podcast with your host, Ted Mills.
Why, hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. This is episode 85. I'm your host, Ted Mills. Thank you for stopping by. Thank you for listening. Thank you for making us part of your regime, your listening regime, whatever that may be. Maybe you're jogging, maybe you're making dinner, I don't know. But thank you. This is the show where I interview artists and creative people, and I try to find out why they do what they do. Today on the show, we have artist Kerry Smith, as well as being an abstract, pointless painter and working in bold colors and angular designs. She has long been a champion for supporting artists with disabilities and is the founder and creative director of Art Walk for Kids and Adults in Santa Barbara. She is also British, and as you'll hear, we have a good laugh dueling accents in this interview, which seems to happen a lot when I run into people from the old country. Just in case you don't know, even though I was born here, right here in Santa Barbara, my family comes from England, and there's a lot of my DNA that's very British. So we had a good time sitting outside on a lovely summer's day and recording this conversation. So we do go on a lot of digression, so I beg your pardon, but I think they're enjoyable, so let me know. You can find out all about Kerry at www.kerrysmith, that's K-E-R-R-I-E, smith.net, and if you want to check out her nonprofit, that is at artwalkforkids.org. She's also a member of Santa Barbara's very large, actually, Abstract Art Collective, which you can find at, you guessed it, abstractartcollective.com. That's very easy. So before we get to that, a little story of what I'm up to. I like to fill you in a little bit more than I usually do on my other jobs outside, my other freelance jobs where I'm sent out on random assignments to write for the paper. Sometimes, you know, that's just okay. Other times I have a little profound moment, so I thought I'd share that with you. So on Saturday, last Saturday, I went to a graduation ceremony for people who come to the Santa Barbara Rescue Mission and who are at the lowest points in their lives. And they agree to go through the Rescue Mission's drug and alcohol program. And this was a gathering at a church. Yes, it is religious. I'm not a big religious fan, but hey, it's not my program. It's not my journey. But these are people that, you know, before they joined the program, it was just absolutely hopeless at the lowest point, I think I said, at their lives. But now after this program, to hear them stand up in front of a huge crowd, tell their stories, it was very moving. I've covered the Rescue Mission before, and it's always a timely check on my own privilege, you know, and just to put yourself in context of the rest of society, how lucky some of us are to have anything close to our normal life, and a lot of these people have nowhere near that, 180 degrees from that normal life, and I think it's just good for your soul to check in sometimes with the more unfortunate people in society. To see change is the stirring thing. Because they stood up, they told their stories. A lot of people told their stories of where they were. Some told it very shortly and thanked people, but they had like two people who spoke at length. And at the core of a lot of these stories, I would say a majority of these stories that I heard, whether they were on drugs or alcohol, that's so many ruined lives in their wake, so many disappointed families, so many bad relationships from marriages and children and such. At the core were all these people. All these people had been abused in some way, either sexually, physically, mentally, a combination of all three, and usually multiple times. And it was that first time, of abuse that turns a happy childhood into something dark. And across the board, that was what I heard. It makes me very angry just to think how someone's childhood could be taken from them so quickly. This was a kid who before that was a happy child, and suddenly this is the way kids think when trauma happens, that they have done something wrong, that they're now the bad child, and they pile all that stuff on. And then everything else that happens is a way of coping with that. And what happened is they grew up. Some of the stories are horrific. I will spare you the details. Some of those things you can probably guess, and others you cannot, because they were just terrible, terrible stuff. Here's the thing, and the reason I'm not trying to bum you out with this thing. The only way that they were finally able to turn things around, to put the brakes on that downward spiral, was by, and this takes time, obviously, was to write the story down, to actually control the narrative. They wrote the story down in their workshops. They write the story down. Some people have suppressed the memory of what actually had happened to them for so long, for 50 years. And finally, when they wrote it down, when they admitted what had happened, when they told their story truthfully, all these things happened from that. It's not a certain enlightenment moment. It's a slow process. It's not simple. I can't imagine why you would think that way, but I'm not trying to make it sound like it's simple. But that first truth that led to another truth and another truth and another truth, and as a philosopher once said, the truth will set you free, right? It's a bloody hard, grueling journey. Now, I'm not telling you this because I have had that trauma. I am very fortunate when I look at the figures that I have not had that trauma, but I do know people who have that. And they have told me that the only way they got out of that was by doing that kind of work, by writing it down, by owning that story. And I'm becoming more and more aware of this as I hear more of these stories. And I'm not telling you personally to do anything. I don't know what your situation is. But maybe someone you know is suffering through this and dealing with this and working on that truth. So one of the main things, listen and spare an ear for them and listen to the story that they're telling you, because it could be very important. So maybe that's what I'm saying. Maybe that's why I'm deciding to tell you this, that listen to people's stories in a lighter way. That's kind of what we do on this podcast. We listen to people's stories. We see what the narrative is. I don't know if that's cheesy to like tie this podcast to that thing that I saw, but there's something at work with the narrative, with the telling of the stories. There's problems with telling narratives about yourself as well, but that's a different introduction to another show altogether, and I'm going to leave that there. Okay, did I make a point? I don't know, but thank you. Thank you for listening. Okay, if you're liking the show, I swear, we're going to get to the interview in just a second. If you're liking the show, please consider joining our mailing list over at funkzonepodcast.com. You're going to hear about all the new shows when they happen. You're going to hear about special deals, and every Friday you get our email. If you're a mailing list subscriber, you get an email from me with 10 links to art. 10 links to art, videos, cool writings, cool stuff, just 10 links. That's it for your Friday afternoon or morning when you're ready to kick off work and not see your boss for 2 days or 3 days, whatever. In the meantime, you can also follow me on Twitter at Ted Mills, and you can like us on Facebook at Funk Zone Podcast. Yes, we are there. And you can subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you find podcasts, and on iTunes. Please leave us a review. We love your reviews. It's lovely. And when I say we, I mean me. You can also show your support by pledging as little as $1 podcast over at our page at patreon.com/funkzonepodcast. A dollar podcast is $4 a month at the least. You could do more if you want. Please do. That is less a month than getting 2 bags of Cool Ranch flavored Doritos, as good as they are, or Fo-Ritos if you shop at Trader Joe's. Have you had those? They're pretty close, actually, so Fo-Ritos. But no, don't buy those. You should subscribe to the Patreon and help support the show. Someone who has done that, I want to give a shout out to CJ Liu, who just joined our Patreon, former guest CJ Liu. Thank you very much, CJ, for doing that. She also has a Patreon of her own you can check out, which is at patreon.com/CJLiu. That's SIGIELOO. Go over there and check that out and listen to the interview we did a couple of months ago to put her in that context. Ooh, also, and I finally can tell you this our 100th and not 100th anniversary, our 2-year anniversary, our 100th episode live show. It's coming up November 18th. Details to come, but put that on your calendar, November 18th, 2016. Oh my goodness, you do not want to miss it. All right, folks, let's get this interview going with Carrie Smith, recorded July 22nd, 2016, at her home, her beautiful home with a beautiful pool. You're going to hear me talk about it. And now served up fresh and piping hot like a good old sausage roll out of the oven. Fwah, what I wouldn't give to have one of those again. Here we go. Carrie Smith, welcome to the Funk Zone podcast.
Thank you, Ted. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's describe the scene to our listeners. We're sitting outside on a very warm Santa Barbara July day, although I think technically we're in Goleta. Are we in Nolita?
I think we're in Nolita.
We're in Nolita.
I like Nolita.
Yeah, it's a nice Nolita day, and we're right next to a pool. Oh, look at this pool. Why can't we do the interview in the pool?
I got a kayak at the end.
We could do that.
Yeah, we could sit
in the kayak. That'd be a first for the show. straight out of a kayak. You have two studios almost. You have here, and then you have in Highland Park.
Yes, I do.
What's the one in Highland Park like? Because this is a very nice residential studio where you're working.
Highland Park, my honey Coleman built a house, mm-hmm. and he has a whole level, which he gave to me.
Oh.
So I have this wonderful space with big windows and lots of light, mm-hmm. and I get to create.
It's abstract. It's pointillist. It's very colorful.
Very colorful.
It just pops out. And you haven't been doing it for that long.
No.
That's the thing. You have a fascinating origin story of how the paintings came about. Someone told you. Get on it. What's that story?
Oh, yeah. That was pretty amazing. About a year and a half ago, I was in D.C. and I met this wonderful artist. She was in her late 80s and she was at the end of her life. Her name was Cynthia Littlefield. And her art just completely got my attention. It was just so abstract, but so personal, so colorful. Not so vibrant as mine, not so fluorescent, but definitely colorful. And I was talking with her. She's right at the end of her life, and we were sharing stories about family and, you know, where we'd lived and our passions in life. And she asked me what I was doing. And I said, well, I'm raising a family and I'm, you know, teaching and being an art affiliator for Art Walk for Kids Adults for Artists with Disabilities. And she said, but what do you want to do? I said, I want to paint. I don't know where it came from. It was so instant. It was so spontaneous. I just said, I want to paint. And I was like, oh, I do want to paint. I kind of been feeling this for a long time inside. You know, I would do little demonstrations for my students. And, you know, I'd worked in a theater and created and painted backcloths. But that was years ago because I've been raising this family. So she said, well, get on with it. And I was like, you're right. I should. So when I came back to Los Angeles, I went and bought all these canvases. It was just like a big, bold move and got these fantastic paints and just set up and started painting. And I started painting just over a year ago. I mean, seriously wanting to paint.
Yeah.
And I haven't looked back. And, you know, every time I go anywhere, I call it my light patterns. You know, they're light patterns to me or dots to other people. Mm. But I feel like I'm recording color and light that I'm experiencing right now in this moment in California.
Yes. I mean, we're sitting here and the light's beautiful.
Yeah.
The colors are beautiful.
Yeah.
How can it not enter your work?
Yeah, completely. It just saturates me. So, and it's sort of like an urban feel, and there is the ocean feel in my work, definitely. You know, people respond to that. They say to me, oh, I see, you know, I see the water. I say, well, yeah, I see Big Sur. I see lots of things. But also that urban experience is definitely there for me, too.
But also color, like there's a lot of neons. There's a lot of pinks.
Yeah.
There's a lot of orange.
Yeah.
A lot of reds. Where?
Lime green.
Yeah, lime green. Where's that coming from?
It's all around me.
Yeah.
Everywhere I look, I see it.
Yeah.
You know, I was up in Big Sur hiking. Oh, just 10 months ago, and I was looking out of the water, and I could just see it, you know. It was green, it was bright blue, it was hot pink, and it was sunset, and it was all there and all around me, and I just have to share that.
Yeah.
So I don't kind of put a lot of thought into it as I'm painting because, you know, it's saturated me, as I said. So I just let it, you know.
I think people listen to the stories and maybe they're in that position when they wonder where the light will go on in their head for them. What does it feel like, and how did you know that this is going to be what you're going to do?
Oh, good question. I think I've always loved theater. Okay, so let's go back to like the early roots for me. I trained in London at Central St. Martin's as a theater designer, and I worked in theater for the first, 10 years of my career. And there's something about going into a theater, the lights are on, the sets come alive, there's a magic there, and everything is super clear. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like hyperrealism, like everything is right there, it's present in front of you. You know, it's right there, it's super bright, it's very clear. I'm not doing anything particularly realistic. I'm not creating great depth of field. I'm not, into that sort of plein air, even though I love looking at plein air. That's not what I'm doing. But I feel that I'm incorporating plein air. I mean, if you look at that piece back there, mm-hmm. Light Pattern 7, they've all got numbers.
Are they just sequential?
Yeah, there's just Light Pattern 7. I can't think of the names and things. That's what they are. There's definitely mountains and ocean in it for me.
Yeah.
But I think it's all down to the individual and how they interpret art. We all see it so differently, don't we?
Yeah. Do you describe that light going off in your head like a flash, like a dam bursting?
Oh, I don't know that about that, but it's definitely exciting. Yeah, it's like a spark.
Hmm.
I just have to do it. You know, I look out at that water and, I'm seeing all those curves and undulations, but I'm seeing it really in this light pattern field.
Did you know that the painting was going to manifest itself in this style?
When I started, with really lots of geometrics. That's how it began. After Big Sur particularly, I just loved the mountains and the ocean. And when I looked at them, to me, it was triangles and rectangles and squares, which is just sort of a really natural way for me to sketch and form space. And I started putting color on and doing these sort of oval areas, and then the ovals would have another oval on top, and there would be three or four ovals, and it just felt really good, really clear. And I just went with it. I mean, I've had a couple of people say to me, are you OCD? Because you've got
are you so, OCD?
I am a bit.
Okay.
Right? I am a bit. And it fits me. It fits my personality at this point in my life to have this. It's almost like there's a control over it. Right? It's not like I'm taking big, broad brush strokes and just going for it, which I have done in the past with backcloths and theater projects. But with this is something that's quite controlled. And I think it came at the right time in my life when I needed that little bit more control. Uh-huh. And it's almost like a meditation for me, a personal meditation. I can sit and I can paint for 6 hours and it just feels totally calming. And that, for me, is a good thing.
You were also describing it earlier as something you can do while you're multitasking.
Oh, yes. Well, I think when you've been a mum for 24 years, which I've been a mum, your days are filled with all kinds of things, and you never know what's going to come up. But, when you're cooking those pancakes and you're vacuuming that room, right, and you're taking out the garbage, you can paint in between. It's not like I have to allocate a set block of time. I can go back and forth, especially because it's in my home, which I love. I'm not sure if I would ever want to be downtown LA. I looked at studio space down there and I thought, oh, this would be wonderful, and it was all like, oh, dreamy, I'd love this space. And then the reality came in. Okay, I would be in this space and I wouldn't be able to do all these other things that I like to do.
Yeah.
The full home life, which comes with the ticket of painting here.
By the way, we're in a flight path.
Oh, yes, we are.
You may hear this. Oh, well.
We'll let that go. There, it's real. We're outside.
There comes the 12:45.
We're in the garden.
Yeah.
garden being very important to me too. I love having nature around me.
Yeah.
My dad was a big influence on that. He used to, wherever we lived, we were in the Air Force and we moved around all the time.
Oh, you're an Army brat.
Oh, yes. Our Royal Air Force brat.
Yeah. Do they call it Army brat in the UK?
They call them RAF brats.
RAF brats.
Yeah. So I was one of those for quite a few years. So I got used to moving around, and wherever we went, my dad would make these beautiful gardens. You know, even if you're only there for like a year, year and a half, that was his art form, his magic. So even though I don't build big rockeries and layer the garden like he does, gardens are really a big part of my happy space. So being here with the doors open and, you know, having the garden and all that natural light.
Yeah. Well, it is that sort of idea of making geographic areas, planting certain things here, certain things there, and then they boop.
Yeah.
Point list.
And they change.
Stuff comes up and they change colors.
All out there. Yeah. All out there, there are all my lovely colors that I love, all these oranges and purples. The oranges are actually starting to go now, but, you know, I wake up and I see all this color and it just resonates.
Yeah. Well, we have to ask about your past. So, Where were you born? Where was that?
I was born in England.
Where?
I was born in Lincolnshire.
Oh, Lincolnshire.
Yeah, but I don't have much of a memory of Lincolnshire because it was one of the Air Force bases, you know. But all my family's from Somerset.
Oh.
Southwest, you know, Street, Glastonbury, Boltonsborough, Ley Lines, Glastonbury Tall.
Yeah.
You know, the
There's certain words you say that there's that Zummerzat accent comes out a bit.
Except when I go back there, they all say I sound American, but I don't think I do anymore. I don't think I sound American or English. I think I've got this sort of accent that's come about from, you know, being a global person.
I've been to Somerset.
Have you?
Yeah, a long time ago. I think when I was like seven. So I can't remember. Well, like Dorset and just
next to Thomas Hardy.
Went around, just toured the countryside.
Yeah,
I remember staying in a country house at some point. Very beautiful. Yeah.
Very nice.
My main thing that I remember is there is a postcard that we bought with a little poem, but written phonetically, so you talked in a Zummerzat accent.
Oh, your tears.
Yes, that's right. So
that's
everything's
the bathroom, by the way.
What's that?
Your tears.
Your tears?
That's the bathroom.
What am I saying?
Your tears. That means it's here.
Oh, your tears.
The bathroom. Your tears.
Your tears.
And you got a Gert Biggin.
Gert Biggin.
A Gert Biggin, which means that's a very large cake, or that's a very large pie, or that's a very large glass of scrumpy cider.
Scrumpy.
You've got a Gert Biggin.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, Wurzel Gummidge, I think.
Scrumpy.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Remember the Wurzels.
Yes.
Remember the Wurzels.
You put those Z's in, or Z's, as some people may say.
And we add ER. So America is Americur.
Americur.
We have a lot of those. So people, actually, when I first moved here, they thought I was from Maine. You know, they said, are you from Maine?
That Maine accent.
No, it's a Somerset accent.
No? What made you think that?
Really? Oh, Ted, that's very good.
I try. I just remember all of the Z's in that postcard.
Yeah,
that's the thing. And there's a picture of, like, you know, a farmer. That kind of thing.
With his smock.
Yeah, with his smock.
A calico smock.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're around, definitely.
Very strong memory of that. I don't know where that went, but anyway, lost to the ashes of time. Probably still available in some shop somewhere down there.
Oh, that's real.
Oh, yeah.
They still wear them. You too can own a Somerset smock.
Yeah. Oh, a Zummerzat smock.
A Zummerzat smock. Ah, my dear. Good on you.
So, if you're, where were you really brought up then?
Well, I was really brought up, I would say, in Somerset, because all my summers were spent with my grandparents, even though, you know, we were moving all over England with Dad being in the Air Force. But, you know, Somerset was always home.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to college in Somerset. I went to boarding school in Somerset. Well, actually, right on the border of Somerset and Wiltshire, because we're sort of sandwiched in between Dorset and Wiltshire. Somerset was always home, and, you know, summers were Stonehenge and the festivals and Glastonbury Fair.
Did you do Glastonbury?
Oh, I did. Yes, I did years ago. I also did Reading and, you know, all the festivals, Reading Pop Festival.
Camping in the mud?
Oh, the whole thing. We're talking about the 70s, late 70s.
Who'd you see? Who'd you see? Glastonbury.
Gosh, who did I I see. I saw Patti Smith in Reading.
Yeah.
I think we saw the Moody Blues one year. I know they came down.
Yeah.
I don't know. So long ago. Lots of great
bands. Hey, if you can remember the festival.
Elvis Costello.
Oh, yeah?
Saw nice. Him quite a few times, actually. Elvis Costello, I remember seeing him for the first time about 1974, and it was in Taunton, which is a local town.
Yeah.
And he came out and he played the entire concert with his back to us. He was so shy.
Really?
And, yeah, it was really
Elvis.
Yeah.
Elvis Costello.
Yeah, he was really shy in the early 70s. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is before he became super famous.
This is when he was still going around as a
He was doing the pubs.
He was doing pubs. He was like he was Declan McManus.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
and his dad, of course, was in a band too.
He was in Joe Loss.
Yeah.
Right, Joe Loss's orchestra.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah, so you saw the early long-haired Elvis Declan.
Oh yeah, early loved Elvis Costello.
That's when he was still writing like Randy Newman and Harry Chapin and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, that's not his. This is your interview.
That's all right. No, I love talking about the past.
What was your family a Royal Air Force family then?
Well, Dad was. You know, he was. Gosh, he was in it for about 30 years and then he left and he became a professor. He taught at different universities. He got his education in the Air Force. In fact, he went in at 16 and he got his degree, everything through the Air Force.
Was this wartime?
No.
Post-war? Where was it?
I'm not that old.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, my dad was in wartime. No, he was in post-war time. He was.
No, this is the 60s. Dad was in 50s and 60s and 70s.
Oh, here comes the 1250.
Here it goes. We're right near Goleta Airport.
Yeah.
Wee.
Lunchtime
special coming by. So, you know, he was in for quite a few years and he got out and he taught for quite a few years. And
what was he teaching?
Engineering.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then he retired and he gardened and potted and he loved to make things. He had the most beautiful workshop. You know, it was just like a beautiful piece of art. You know, every tool was on the wall and he drew around every tool so it always went back in the right place.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and all his shells had jam jars screwed in, so with all his nuts and bolts and things. And Dad could make anything. Yeah. He could do anything. He could fix anything. And then Mum was a complete entrepreneur. She self-educated, businesswoman, opened stores, consignment, antiques, bric-a-brac. You name it, she did it. House clearance, auctions.
Yeah.
And she did that for about 35 years and quite a character and moved here 2 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, she's next door, right?
Yeah, she's next door. I built her a little house.
Oh.
She's right over there.
Hello, Mum.
Very happy. She loves it and she loves the climate. And
who wouldn't?
Making lots of new friends because... Whoa. She's the right age.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
We've got lots of people in their 80s and 90s in this town, so she's meeting tons of people.
She's getting out there.
Yeah, she is. She's
good.
She's got her GPS.
Oh, yeah.
She's got her iPhone, and there's no stopping her.
Yeah.
Annie.
Good.
Annie.
Good old Annie.
Yeah.
So when you were in high school, what we call high school, and then you went to college, what was that, theater that you were tending towards at that time?
Yeah, I went to the local art school
in
Yeovil. Yeah, called the Park Art School. It was absolutely wonderful. It was this beautiful old Victorian house, and they converted it into a very creative space. There was kinds of mediums. I mean, you get to paint and sculpt and jewelry making and photography, and it was called a foundation course. And I just think the foundation courses are wonderful. We don't have them so much in America, but it really gives you a time out. It gives you a year in the arts to kind of figure out where your interests lie. Now, CCA, California College of the Arts, do offer a foundation year. My son just took it.
Do they call it a foundation course?
Yeah, they call it the foundation year. And he's actually going into architecture, so he took the foundation year. And it was just really good. It cemented so many things. So I did that and had a great teacher there. What was her name? I'm trying to remember. Pam. And she said to me, what do you want to do? And I thought, I'd really like to study sculpture. And she said, well, you know, let's look at London. Let's look at possibilities. And she said, you know, there's so many other things you like. You love to paint. You love to weld. You know, you like to build, create, make. You're pretty good at drawing. She said, have you ever thought about theater? And I was like, no. Theater, you know, theater what? Theater what? She said, theater design. And she was the one who said, why don't you apply to Central St. Martin's? And I went up with my dad in the back of his old car, and I took sacks of projects. I mean, you have to do like a little 2-hour overview of your portfolio. And in those days, I didn't have the portfolio on sheets. Everything was made because I was such a hands-on artist. And we just took up garbage bags filled with things. Yeah. And I got up to Central, and they showed me into this room, and there was this long table. They probably put together 4 or 5 6-foot tables. And they said, you can set up. So I hauled everything in, and I can remember now just tipping it all out on this table. There were piles of bits and pieces and ceramics and little heads and bits of metal and everything I had made in this 1 year foundation course. And about 8 of the jurors, you know, staff came in and sat down, and they started picking through everything, and they loved it.
It's like a jumble sale.
It was like a Kerry's jumble sale. And it was just great. I got this great reception from them, and they just said, you know, we want you, come. And I just felt so honored. Mm. I felt so thankful and so relieved, because, you know, interviewing to go on to a school in London for me was a big deal, being a country bumpkin.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, we're going to tell you now that you're accepted so you can get into the Hall of Residence to make sure you get a place to live.
All in one day?
Yeah, all in one day. So that was it.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I'd also applied to Wimbledon. But I knew I didn't want to go there. I wanted to go to Central. I always wanted to go to Central.
Where's Central located?
In those days, it was in Old Holborn, Bloomsbury. Hmm. And it was just Central School of Art and Design. And then they partnered up with St. Martin's. And now they're up by St. Pancras, I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So living in London, right in the city.
Oh, God, it was fun.
How was it?
I loved it.
How was the Halls of Residence?
That lasted about 6 months.
You know,
then you find your buddies who you want to live with. And then we all moved out to the East End of London, and I was down by Wapping Wharf. And, you know, there were lots of studios and warehouses, spaces and tenement buildings. And, you know, they were cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were moldy. And, you know, communal kitchens and bathrooms. And it was so much fun. We used to go out at the end of the day, and there was all these Indian markets, Bangladesh markets, and at the end of the day, anything that was on the floor was free, right? Any food, any vegetables, any fruit. So we would go with these big baskets, and we would fill it with all this food, and we had these enormous pots. We were like these witch pots, you know, they're massive cauldrons, and we would make ratatouille for 40 or 50 people.
Yes, that's the way to do it.
Living on nothing, you know, really. I mean, we didn't buy meat. It was all vegetarian.
Yeah.
And very healthy.
Yeah, very healthy.
Yeah, very healthy. But we were broke, and you know, that's how we fed one another, and it was great fun. I loved my London days.
And you had a local pub.
We did, but we weren't kind of, you know, in the way that we could go buy pints of beer. We didn't have that much money. We were more into buying our own beers and sitting out on the steps.
Yeah.
But there was a couple bars down at St. Catherine's Docks, which were rather nice.
Was this one of those institutions where you had to go drinking with your instructors?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
See, that's so not the case here. But
lunchtime.
There,
yeah. Can you imagine? You know, you'd be, you know, studying, I don't know, new Saclakite movement, or, you know, some movement in art. And then Peter Avery, who was our art history teacher, and he'd say, okay, he's coming for a pint.
That's right.
And we had our own bar at Central.
You did?
Yeah.
Nice.
There was the I don't know, professor's bar, but, you know, the students would go in and everybody would have a pint.
Good prices too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because
it's 21.
Because it's subsidized,
yeah.
Because it's on campus.
Yeah,
oh.
21p for a pint. And we'd go have a pint, and then we'd go back to class, and everybody would be pretty mellow for an
hour. Yeah, pretty mellow.
And then we'd stay there till about 10 at night, because they didn't kick you out, you know. And we had so many night projects. We were working on, you know, installations and sets for the National Theatre.
Yeah.
We were working at the Old Vic. We were working at Hammersmith Studios. So, you know, it was just amazing. Everybody was full on, and we would pull all-nighters. We had our own theatre called the Cottesloe Theatre. So, you know, we'd camp out in the workshops.
Yeah. God. Can you imagine if you took your students out for a pint here, you'd be you wouldn't be a teacher for a while.
Yeah. No, just, very different.
Come on, everybody.
Time. Yeah, very different time. Very special time. And I'm still in touch. You know, Pamela Howard, who was my, you know, best and favorite of all my professors. I actually became her assistant and worked at Chichester Theatre. But she is 75. She's now an MBE.
Mm-hmm.
And
MBE. She got an MBE.
Yeah, she got an MBE. And last summer I went back and visited her, and she was exactly the same. We hadn't seen each other in years, and she met me at the train station, and her hair was flame red. She's kind of, you know, in this bright orange coat. From a distance, she looked like a fireball coming up the platform, and it was just wonderful to see her. So I feel very fortunate. I'm still in touch with some of these just great creators of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even now. She's the head of the Welsh National Opera.
Oh, wow.
She's designing all over the world, yeah.
You mentioned some studios, too. So were you doing theater and some TV or film?
I was working down at Riverside Studios with Peter Gill. And I was one of the assistant designers down there, and we did a lot of Shakespeare. I didn't do so much television until I came out to the States. I did work on a PBS miniseries.
Oh, yeah.
Called Roanoke, about the first British settlers.
Get out of here. I'm obsessed with Roanoke.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was helping with costumes. So there you go. Oh. How do you know about Roanoke? did you watch it? It was a big miniseries.
No. A friend of this was a project that still on the back burner, but a friend and I wrote a script for a movie to be based about Roanoke, because it is the fascinating lost colony story, and that's, we've been kicking that around, and he just wrote a few more drafts on his own, but it's something we've both been obsessed about, because it's such a fascinating story.
Yeah, I think it's a PBS miniseries. It was made in the 80s.
Where they shoot it?
They shot it down in Charlestown and Myrtle Beach, and those little islands with their houses on stilts.
So they went back to where they actually...
And they had real Indians who came in.
Yeah. Did the thing.
Oh. Yeah. That's where I learned to fish. I learned how to do surf fishing for bluefish there.
Oh, yeah?
The Indian family took me out, and it was just amazing. All these bluefish would be, you know, 15, 20 feet off the shore, and you could catch them, and then we'd eat them.
How are you catching them?
With our rods.
Oh, yeah, okay.
We've been just surf fishing at night, and they're big, juicy fish. I love fish. I love oily fish, like mackerel, you know, Englishy fish.
And kippers.
Kippers. Love kippers. And, so we would catch these fish and cook them right there,
You're going to be handy in the apocalypse.
I am. I'm an adventure. My adventure girl. My boys always say to me, "Mom, you're always up for an adventure."
That's good.
Yeah, I still am, actually. I'm definitely got a few more trips in me.
I don't want to say too long in the talking about the theater, but you must have seen some good Shakespearean productions.
I did. I was very fortunate to be an assistant to a wonderful designer called Ralph Koltai, who's actually still alive.
Oh, yeah?
He's 94.
Yeah.
And a kinetic artist. He worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company, so I did work on a couple of productions there. He also worked as a designer for Ken Russell, so I was very fortunate. I got to work on a big opera in France, in Lyon.
This is when he was not making movies, he was doing...
Yeah,
which opera did he do?
We did one by Zimmerman called Die Soldaten, The Soldiers, I think it was called. And it was a very, for the day, risque set design. It was a huge woman's crotch with a swing and these massive breasts, torso, and they had all these projections of images. And so I worked on that production.
Did you get to work with Ken Russell?
Yeah, I did get to meet Ken.
What was he like?
Yeah, he was actually, I would say he was really an easy person to work for, because he was very clear about what he wanted and very accessible.
It's very hard to see his films these days.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything for a long time.
Well, if you want to watch The Devils, or if you want to watch some of the early stuff, they're not around.
No, I don't even get them on Netflix. I did see Insignificance. He did that one.
That was Nicholas Rogue.
Nicholas Rogue. I'm trying to think the last thing. I don't know.
Lair of the White Worm. Have you seen that
one? Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, my God.
Have you got any of these copies?
I think I may.
And I have to borrow them.
My friend has a line on a copy of The Devils, which you can't get.
Yeah, why is that?
Rights issues. So don't ask me where he got it.
There you go.
Lair of the White Worm, though, is on Netflix, and it's just, you got
to see. Oh, well, I'm going to have to see.
You got to see. It's got Peter Capaldi in it.
No.
And it's so insane. I remember watching it a long time ago when I was young, and I was like, oh, okay. But then when I rewatched, I'm like, I don't remember this being so nuts. I mean,
it really is nuts.
I don't know. Somewhere in the UK.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. It's a Bram Stoker story, but it has like Amanda Donahoe in it as
when she was a modeling.
Oh yeah, she's very hot and sexy in this film. She seduces a Boy Scout because she's like a vampire snake creature kind of thing.
Oh my God.
It's just so silly, and Capaldi is. Anyway, I don't want to spoil it. You just gotta see it because it's
okay. That's on the bucket list.
You'll just laugh like how did this get made, sort of thing. It's very Ken Russell. So how did you get out here to the ye olde states?
Well, now this is kind of a whole nother part of my life. I was at Central, like most students, you're starving students. So I did a little bit of modeling on the side. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate. There was an agency called Models One Elite in London. Mm. And I was at some dance disco or something in those days.
Yeah.
And this lady came over to me, Jose. I think her name was Jose. Anyhow, she said, oh, I have this modeling agency. Have you ever thought of modeling? I said, well, I'm a student. I'm an art student. She said, perfect. Come and see me. So, it was in Chelsea. It was like miles from me.
Yeah.
You know, like an hour on the subway, 5 bus rides.
Yeah.
But I made it. I got down there and I went to see the agency, and I walked in and she said, we'd like to send you out for a test. They call it test photos in those days.
Because you had no photos, probably.
No, I didn't have anything.
Nothing.
Nothing.
No.
And I went to a lovely photographer called Anthony Crickmay, who's since passed. Wonderful photographer. He actually photographed a lot of the ballet at Covent Garden. So I walked in and I said, I'm here for a test. And he was just terrific. He made me feel so relaxed. He said, oh, sit down. He said, I'm going to do a couple roles. And he did that couple of roles. And then that couple of roles became like several jobs. And I guess, you become flavor of the month. And all of a sudden I was working as a model. And also being a student, juggling the two. And then, of course, in the summer holidays, you have these long vacations in England, like you do here for the students, 3 months. And I would get these jobs. And one of my jobs was to come out to America.
Ah.
And it was for a catalogue. I think it was Marks and Spencer's catalogues or Littlewood's catalogues, one of the catalogues in England. And they sent me to Arizona. And I had never, ever been to the States. So
here
I was,
yeah,
via Somerset, London, in Arizona, shooting fur coats in August. All right. A little bit crazy.
Yeah.
And sportswear. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was like 100 degrees. I mean, it was dry.
Yeah.
So the lighting was perfect, apparently. Lovely blue skies made the coats glisten. Everything looked beautiful.
Yeah.
Fur pieces and sports clothes and all kinds of things. And I did that for about 2 weeks. Made a truckload of money compared to, what I was living off. And thought, this isn't bad.
Yeah,
I think I might, do this again. And I was very fortunate. Model Ones, they were great. They got me terrific clients and shows. I ended up going over to Germany and doing a lot of work for Neckermann and Otto and staying in Hamburg. And then they said to me, had you ever thought of going to the States? And I said, no.
Not if it's like Arizona the time.
Not like, really, working there. And they said, well, we think you'd do really well in New York. And it was that time when, it was a lot of blonde-haired, blue eyes, small features.
What year are we talking?
Hmm?
What year are we talking?
We're talking like 84.
Okay.
There was definitely a market then for that look. And I was very fortunate. I arrived in New York and I was initially with an agency called Wilhelmina for 6 months and thought I would just go for 6 months. And then 6 months became a year and I moved over to Ford. And then that became 2 years. And before you know it, you're sort of in the States and you're making a life. And I was doing a little bit of theater, working with, what was his name? An English director, John Tillinger.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working on Autumn Play, the Joe Autumn Play. So I was assisting him a little bit and modeling a little bit and getting to know America. And I ended up meeting my ex-husband, and that was it.
Where did you first live? Did you stay in New York?
I lived, the first place I lived was in Brooklyn Heights. Then I moved into the city. And I moved in with him after a few months. And we lived in the West Village, right on Sullivan Street, which was really fun. Had bicycles, you know, rode everywhere.
Yeah, I bet.
Everywhere. Oh, it was just great. We used to go to Danceteria and dance on the rooftops. And, you know, all these Area 51, I think it was called. All these great old
54.
Clubs. 54.
Studio 54.
No, no, not Studio 54. It was downtown. It was called Area.
Okay.
And it was this huge nightclub. And, you know, in those days, everybody would come in from all over the suburbs and there'd be this big crowd. I don't know what it's like today, so I don't do any of that. And then this person would be at the front of the club and they would like be like the magician or the magic person who would point a finger and you were allowed in and you were allowed in, you know, or if you were on a list. And of course, because, you know, you're modeling in those days, you're in. They always want the models in all the clubs.
Yeah.
So you turn up and they would go, point, come on in, and you go in and party a bit and get to know that whole New York scene, which was just a big eye-opener for me. I'd never seen anything quite like it. I remember very early on going to the Lower East Side to this basement party, and it was Keith Haring.
Oh, yeah.
Right? He'd paint, this is like 84. Yeah, it must have been 84. And he had painted everything from ceiling to floor.
Mm.
And just thinking, wow. This is a cool space. This is like theater in the round.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
All there. So that was my New York experience. And then I came out to Los Angeles and I started to work with commercials, which was a whole nother world, you know.
You mean the being an actress in the commercial?
Yeah, it was a strange thing. I was on a modeling assignment. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. I hadn't thought about doing commercials at all. And I walked by a door, and it was a Mercedes-Benz team. They were looking for somebody to launch the Mercedes-Benz. And I just happened to look the right look. I had the very short blonde hair. You know, I was wearing like a little suit thing. And they said, oh, come in. And I went, who? And they said, you. So I came in and I was very fortunate. I booked the campaign. So I started doing commercials. So that was another.
You've walked into a lot of things.
I have. Yeah. You know, it has been like that. And it's interesting because when I started my nonprofit, Art Walk for Kids Adults, my mission is, through positive self-expression, the doors of opportunity will open for you. And, you know, it has been like that. I've walked through a lot of different doors at the right time. But you have to work hard. I mean, it's not like you just walk through and here's, you know, a few $1,000. I mean, you know, you do have to work for it.
Mm.
And commercials are very labor-intensive. You have to do multiple takes.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, not always easy, especially when you're doing a Taco Bell commercial and you have to have 50 bites out of one taco. That wasn't so much fun with a spit bucket at the side.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I did that for a little while and worked down at the Mark Taper Forum.
Was I getting back in the theater to that?
That was
then?
Yeah, it was. John came out. He was working on autumn plays, so I assisted him for a little bit there. I also worked in fundraising at the Mark Taper when the actor strike came. There was very little work. I think it was like 91, very slow time, 1991. So I started working in the fundraising department at the Mark Taper. They paid a salary.
Mm-hmm.
And I got quite good at that, actually. those little scripts. I would start writing those little scripts that the telemarketers would use.
Oh, yeah.
That went quite well.
You're fundraising by phone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite fun, actually. You know, you sort of get to know people and what they like and don't like. And, yeah, I quite enjoyed that. So I did that for about a year. Then I went out to Colorado and got involved with a big project, 840 acres with six friends, including my ex-husband, and we had 840 acres that we developed into 34-acre ranches. Mm-hmm. And that was a two-year project, and lived in a little airstream on the land.
Yeah.
That was a whole nother experience with two solar panels.
By this time, you'd left all your modeling.
I just wanted to get out of it. And then I really wanted a child.
Yeah.
And that was 91, and I was very blessed. I got pregnant and had Ben, who's now 24.
And off to study architecture.
No, that's the younger one.
Oh, that's the other one.
He's 19. Sam. Ben he lives here at the moment. He's working over at Sansom in dermatology, and he's about to go back to school. He thinks he's going to be a nurse practitioner.
Ah, okay.
So he sort of stayed local. And then Sam, the younger one, he's up in San Francisco. He's studying architecture, next 4 years.
Now, how'd you get to Santa Barbara?
Well, after I was married for some years, I realized that this wasn't where I wanted to be in my life. So I needed to be somewhere where I could raise a family and that they could still have a relationship with their father. He was living in LA by then. And it just seemed like the place to check out. But I didn't come here immediately. I went over to Ojai and I looked at homes there. And I remember the realtor saying to me, "Are you sure you want to live here? You've lived in cities. Are you sure you can live in a small community?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but the houses are affordable. You know, I could get a home here." And she said, "Well, I think you should take a look at Santa Barbara." And I said, "Well, isn't that just for the very, very wealthy?"
Mm.
And she said, "Well, actually, there are real neighborhoods."
Amazingly enough.
You don't have to be a multi-millionaire to live in Santa Barbara. So I came up here the following weekend and I looked all around Goleta and Hope Ranch Annex and, you know, all these little wonderful neighborhoods with great schools. And this was the house she showed me at the end of the day.
Oh, how long have you been here?
And I've owned the house since 95.
Nice.
But I didn't live in it all the time. I, you know, had time away from it and I rented it out. And then I moved back here full time 2 years ago. Full time meaning I have my possessions here and my art here and my mum here and my son over there.
Now the whole family's here.
Yeah. So we've got, it's really nice. We have a base here and I can't imagine ever not having a base, you know, in Santa Barbara. I really, really love it. And as much as I love to travel and spend time in L.A., I just have to be here as well.
So tell me a little bit about the nonprofit that you set up and why and how that started.
Okay, so that was 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching art part-time and doing art camps right here in this back garden for kids in the summer called Art and Swim. I had a lot
art
of
and swim.
Art and swim.
Do a little bit of art, dive into the pool.
They would come in, they would do an art project. I'd base it around a famous artist, you know, break it down for them so they could create something that they loved. And then we'd have swim.
Oh.
And they'd stay for like 3-4 hours and then maybe we'd go in the kitchen and cook.
Bring back art and swim.
Yeah, it was really fun. So I would do that for about 8 weeks. And then I had this jazz band from Russia who would come and rent my house for a month every year. And I'd go back to England with the boys. And there was, I think there were like 15 people in this jazz band. And they just put down pads and, you know, beds and like bunk beds and, you know, two sets of bunk beds. And so it was their pad for a month. I didn't care as long as they paid me. And I would scoop the boys up and we'd go back to Somerset and have a month there. So that was kind of the seeds that were sown for Art Walk, going back to that question, because I did the art swim.
Yeah.
Then I decided I really wanted to work with artists with disabilities. I had an autistic brother who passed away at 34, and I've always had a connection with artists with disabilities, even in London. I worked with a director called Lucy Parker, and we worked with young teenagers recovering from drugs. and did theatre productions. They wrote their own plays and we created the sets. So I just liked that community. And I was very fortunate. I got a small grant from Fund for Santa Barbara and the Santa Barbara County Arts Commission. It was Davis, what was his first name? Oh, it's gone. He's now retired. Anyway, he was the executive director, and they said, we'll umbrella you. You can be under us, 501c3. And the Arts Fund gave us this small grant, and I went up to Los Prietos Boys Camp, and I started an art program up there for incarcerated youth.
Oh.
And I did that for about 3 years. And then it grew. It became Los Prietos Tri-Counties Boot Camp, it became Juvenile Hall, then it became El Puente, working with kids there. And then I started working out at Devereux, 3 days a week working with autistic adults and autistic kids. So that's how it all came about, Art Walk for Kids Adults. And it's still going because I have a program over at Hillside House. I mean, I'm not so full on with it because it's, you know, what we're now 15 years in. But I still do it and I still put together art shows for my students. Television, TV Santa Barbara have given us all their wall space ongoing. So every 3 months we have an artist there. We frame and they have their own opening, which is just so good for their self-esteem. So, yeah, I still have private clients as well. So I'm very fortunate. I keep my art walk very much.
I can understand that why that was building up in you when you got asked what you want to do and probably why you said paint.
Yeah.
Because you must have been seeing this. Oh. You've been teaching it, but you've been seeing it happen.
Yeah.
I guess you did some. You did some painting to show, obviously.
Oh yeah,
but
I'm
not
always demonstrating. Yeah. But I didn't have the luxury of the time to take for myself, and now I have that luxury. The boys are older, and I'm blessed to live here. And this is the perfect time for me to start painting. You know, it's never too old. As Cynthia said, in her late 80s, at the end of her life, you know, she started painting really seriously as an artist in her, I think in her late 40s. And she said, just get on with it.
Hmm. When was your first show when you started doing this?
I joined a local group called the Abstract Art Collective. And I wasn't sure where that was going to go, but I thought, you know, it's great to have camaraderie and have other artists that you can have a dialogue with. So I joined just about a year ago, and I started sharing with them. And I had a piece up at the Faulkner, and had a very nice review, and ended up getting a second prize for that. Not that prizes should be a big deal, but it's very nice to know that somebody else gets what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I think it was Mesa who wrote about it.
Oh.
Yeah. And then I they had other smaller shows, and they have one at the moment over at the Jewish Federation. I put a large piece in called Land Patterns, Freedom Flight, and I think it's Voice. It used to be Casa, now it's Voice. They use that on the front of their page. And I made a little website, you know, and a little Facebook page, and I started showing my art. And then I went down to LA and I joined the Los Angeles Art Association.
Oh.
And they have a great gallery, so now I'm going to show art down there as well. And my main focus is to work on a one-woman show, so I'm sort of holding on to a lot of the light patterns. I've shown out at Arturo's Palm Loft Gallery as well. I just had 3 paintings there. And there's so many lovely local galleries. The Carpinteria Arts Center, I've had 4 or 5 pieces there and individual shows. And I just find Santa Barbara incredibly supportive. Lots and lots of great women painting, and men, but mostly I'm meeting the women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's spurring me on.
Yeah.
Just got to keep doing it.
Yeah.
And now being in LA, I go to all these fabulous openings in downtown and meeting gallery owners and other artists, and, you know, very supportive there too. I'm just getting great response from my work. So I'm just going to keep going. So thank you, Ted, for asking me to come and talk about my work.
Are we thinking 2017 for your solo show?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
I think it takes, you know, when you start painting, you're not sure. Well, for me, I wasn't sure where it was going to go, but it keeps coming out, light patterns. And here I am, you know, as I said, I'm like a dozen in, and I would really, to have a woman show, I need at least 20 finished and maybe 5 in reserve.
Yeah.
So I think another year.
Yeah.
It does take time.
Are you going to develop any other style, or do you think
well, I
this
do.
Is going to continue?
Well, I do. I also have land patterns.
Okay.
So I have light patterns and I have land patterns. Land patterns mostly of what I've shown here in Santa Barbara. And then I have my urban land patterns, which are all about wires and telegraph and transmitters, and they're far more urban. And so I've been showing those down in LA. So, yeah, I definitely have 3 or 4 groupings. And then these are, there's 2 of these, and there's a 3rd one, my victories. They're on the go at the moment, too. So, you know, I think the more you paint, the more that comes about, the more groupings, for me anyway.
Well, who knows when people are listening to this, because they may be listening to it next year just before your show opens.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows, Ted? But I'll just keep doing it because I have to.
Yeah. Well, this has been a nice talk. Thank you for having me over.
I hope I didn't rabbit on too much.
Oh, no, rabbit's good. Rabbit. It's good stuff. All right. Thank you very much, Carrie.
Thank you, Ted.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
There you have it, folks. Carrie Smith. Very charming interview there with Carrie Smith. Very British interview. I hope you enjoyed it. And it was so lovely sitting by that pool. I so wanted to dive in that pool. Maybe she will invite me back. You can find her at www.carriesmith.net. I'll spell that for you. K-E-R-R-I-E smith.net. That's right. Okay. For me, you can join the mailing list. Please do that over at funkzonepodcast.com. You can find me on Twitter at Ted Mills. And I'm on Facebook at Funk Zone Podcast. Ooh, and go leave us a review on iTunes. Please. Okay, enough begging from me. Thanks for listening. That was fun. I will be back next week with, oh my goodness, a Fiesta-themed podcast. What? Fiesta? What? I don't know what that is. If you're not in Santa Barbara, that is old Spanish days. Look it up on your Googly. Special Fiesta-themed show. Details to come. Okay, that's it for me. Now, I'm going to turn it over to my second grade friend, Joseph. He will lead us out. Take us away, Joe. See you, folks. Bye.
And now for a big goodbye. See you soon. We'll make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make some more tapes later on. Bye. My big friend. More tapes later on. Yeah. See you soon. Bye.